Eric, do you want to tell us when they roll? Should we wait a minute or two?
Yeah, let's look through.
Wait, coming in.
Yeah.
Right under here. I was going to lift it up. One, two, three.
Moving and grooving.
The sound will be better if you,
like this.
If you pass it through the next person, whoever's going to talk, and, if you were talking, and Mark chimes in, Mark will be sort of off stage.
Oh, I won't surrender the mic.
Other than that, forget about it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was told I should introduce you.
Oh, perfect, Henry. Yeah, I'd love to. Great.
Good morning. My name is Henry Wigglesworth, and I teach at Seattle University School of Law, along with Meredith Berger. And I'm just going to briefly introduce, I think I'll just talk loudly. Can you all hear me? It's about the size of my normal classroom, so I'll just project, and hopefully you can hear me. I'm just going to briefly introduce, okay. I'll take direction from Eric Salzman, who is a famous TV director from way back. I want to just briefly introduce the panelists and then open it up to them. Jack Buswalk, whom I've never met, it's good to see him for the first time. You may know from the book, if you've read the book, as the expert witness who testified for Grace at trial on the hydrogeology aspect of the case. Michael Keating, sitting next to him, was the trial lawyer for Grace, who sort of took over the reins of the case from Bill Cheeseman once the trial began. So next to Mr. Keating is Bill Cheeseman, who handled the case in the early stages, filed the renowned Rule 11 motion, and also did a lot of other pretrial maneuvering, which perhaps he'll talk about today.
I left my funny hats at home today.
And Mark Stoller, who represents W.R. Grace as counsel, in-house counsel?
In-house counsel, then, and director of Environment, Health, and Safety today.
Okay. All right, so with that, I'll turn it over to the panel. Mike Gray.
Good. Eric, would you like us to stand? How would you like to?
It doesn't matter.
All right, why don't we not, or as we choose. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Keating. I'm a partner at Foley, Hoag, and Elliott, and as Henry stated, I was the lead trial counsel for W.R. Grace in the Anderson versus Cryovac case. You've had my fellow panelists introduced, and I'm only going to say a couple of words at the beginning, and then I'll also be participating further as the hour goes on. The question that I'm asked most frequently about this case, not only around the time the case was going on, but also as recently as a couple of days ago when I spoke to a group of 11th graders who had read the book, was how did I feel about representing a corporation that had been accused of conduct which had caused the death and injury to children? That issue was a great concern to me because, as you know from the book, I actually came into this case quite late in the game. Bill had been working with Mark and Jack on this case for many years in the office, and then when it appeared that the case was going to go to trial, I was asked if I would try the case for Grace. And the first thing I learned about the case was what I just articulated to you a moment ago, the seriousness of the case, the seriousness of the accusations that had been made against Grace, and obviously the overwhelming tragedy that the plaintiffs and their families had suffered. The easy answer to the question that's posed to me so often about my role in this case was one I would have been satisfied with, which is that I'm a lawyer, I am a believer in the adversarial system, I believe that court cases have to be vigorously litigated by persons who have zealously represent respective interests, and that hopefully what will emerge from that is the truth about a situation. And I could have stood on that comfortably, frankly. But it really wasn't enough for me at the time, because this is not a usual case, and the accusations are not the usual accusations, and the tragedies are not the usual tragedies. So I felt incumbent upon myself to really try to get to the bottom of what I thought was Grace's responsibilities in this case. I had to do that not only because I felt I needed to have that feeling morally to represent the company, and I wasn't going to rely just on the fact that as a lawyer I had an obligation to represent my client zealously, but I knew that the nature of this case and the difficulty of this case is such that unless I felt committed to the position that I was advancing in the courtroom and was continually advancing over the course of what was a 6-month trial, but we at the time perceived could well have gone for over a year, that I would have difficulty doing that. I would be less effective as an advocate for one thing, and I would have difficulty, I think, internally. What I concluded, and I'll deal with this more extensively when I make my own comments, was that I believe then and I believe now that there was no conduct of Grace that contributed to the illnesses of those children and those families in Woburn. I believe that then, and I believe that today. And the reason that I have come to that conclusion is based largely on the roles of my fellow panelists. Mark Stoller, who was Grace's in-house counsel for environmental matters, worked very, very closely with us from well before I was involved in the case, but also throughout the trial. My partner, Bill Cheeseman, who's one of our leading environmental lawyers in our firm, as you know from the book, had worked very closely with Grace and had worked very closely in analyzing the Cryovac facility and the conduct that had occurred there. Jack Guswa on my left, in my opinion, and I'll say it at the beginning, was the star of the Cryovac, of the Anderson versus Cryovac case. I thought he was a wonderful witness. I thought he had worked very, very hard. It was a result of the work of these three individuals and other people in my firm, and I'll deal with that when I speak, that I came to that conviction, which I wanted to share with you at the beginning because it is the thing that I'm often asked about. So without hearing now further from me, let me turn the mic over to Mark and he can speak.
Mark, before you turn the mic over.
Yes.
That mic died.
Okay, then I was going to stand up, but, or can I? Okay, yes, we are.
Well, I put it out of the way.
Okay, well, let me move over because I just want to do it while I'm speaking.
Okay,
because it may be a. Okay, I'll move over here. Okay. What we'd like to do today is actually walk you through a narrative that gives you some more information that you may not have from the book about what we knew about the facts both before and after this litigation, because it helped give some context to what we were doing. And it also, I think, will make you understand what we were trying to do was figure out what the facts were so that we could then figure out what our defense was. A word before I do that about my own personal reservations about the focus of a legal action on a continuing basis on lawyers and litigation. It's great for teaching law, I guess, if y'all like doing that, but I'm not sure that's where the real lessons out of this apply. Working for a company or if you're in a community, I think the real lessons here are a bit different. The litigation was a litigation about a subset of the chemicals that were in the wells and about a subset of the potential sources of that subset of chemicals. It's not a story about the environment in Woburn. The real lessons, I think, ultimately here are preventive lessons, things that we can look at today going forward. You know, what do you do about protecting a water supply if you're a provider of water? What do you do if you're like us and handle hazardous materials and you want to avoid these situations from arising again? And when situations like this arise, are the ways other than the litigation as war approaches, Janet Schlickman has said, to try to resolve these. So personally, that's where I think the lessons and the emphasis should be. But now we'll give you what you came for, and that's a... We're gonna talk, and then at the end have some brief time for questions. No. Because we do want to lay out some things that I think most of you haven't heard before. This case, or this matter, began for us at the beginning of 1982 when our plant got an information request from EPA and responded to talking about an incident where there had been waste disposal on the site and some chemical usage. 3 months later, this lawsuit was filed, and that's when the Foley Hoag involvement began and my personal involvement began. The lawsuit was a shock to us because a small machine shop to us was not, in the context of 1982, a big environmental threat. We know a lot more now than we did then. But what we did when that lawsuit was filed, we started down a road of trying to figure out what had happened at the plant. We interviewed our long-term, current, and former employees about what they knew, reviewed our records. We were hampered somewhat by the lack of records before the mid-1970s. We talked to suppliers. We talked to the people who actually built the plant and built all the additions to the plant. When we finished that process, we had information that showed that we had used more chemicals and there had been more disposal on our plant site than had been listed in our response to EPA earlier in 1982. In early 1983, we gave that information to both EPA and the plaintiffs. In fact, the plaintiffs held a press conference about it. Based upon that information and based upon, as we talked around to other people, some other things that were coming up around the country on small machine shops and small-scale disposal, we realized we needed to start doing a groundwater investigation, which we began in 1983. We started a program in the spring of 83 to look for buried drums on our property and to put groundwater monitoring wells in. We started that on a voluntary basis in April of 83. And in May of 83, EPA issued us an order to conduct that same work, which we did, and we fully complied with the order. In August of 83, almost 3 years prior to the trial, we found out, we did discover that we had groundwater contamination on our property, including trichloroethylene in the groundwater, and that groundwater was moving off-site in the direction of those wells a half mile away. We completed the work in April of 84, and I just do want to show you this, because all I want to tell you about this is public record. This is from our report to EPA in April of 1984, in which we proposed to do additional work both on our property and off our property. And you'll see, and this is Grace saying this, in order to better define the relationship between volatile organic chemicals, and that includes trichloroethylene, found in Cryovac on-site, in EPA wells off-site, and to better delineate possible movement in terms of quantity and velocity of on-site contamination towards wells G&H, we recommended installing wells between Grace and wells G&H. We offered to do that under a further order to EPA. They declined, but we went ahead with that work voluntarily with advance notice to EPA and turning the results over to them. I hope what this part of the narrative makes clear that as of the fall of 2 years prior to the actual start of the trial, from Grace's perspective in terms of admissions, what was on the record, we had acknowledged using some of these chemicals as early as 1964. There had been disposal on the site. They were in the groundwater, and there was movement towards the wells. So from our perspective, the technical issue that really remained very early on here was the issue of timing. Could they have reached those wells prior to their closure in 1979? It was also very clear to us very early on that in terms of liability we had to EPA under the Superfund program that we were going to be involved in a cleanup because of the results of that disposal and contamination. With that, I want to turn it over to Bill Cheeseman for a couple of minutes to talk about some of the motion practice that went on from 1982 to 1984 during this period.
I should switch with you again, Mark. The medical causation issues are given very little attention in the book and literally none in the movie, which just assumes that the chemicals caused leukemia, because the case was concluded before we got to that phase of the trial. In fact, Jonathan Haar rused the settlements in the case because it deprived him of some better material for his book. But the medical issues were addressed in the book and in the case to some extent in the early motions that I filed, and that's what I want to talk about here. I think many of you use those from a civil procedure perspective, and I'll talk about those issues as well. Because time is limited, I'll try to focus on telling you some things that aren't in the movie and that I believe some of them at least are not in the book either, give you a little position of superiority over your students when you teach the course. Starting with Rule 11, first, I did not file the Rule 11 motion on a whim, as the movie suggests and to some extent the book suggests. What happened was that an article in the Providence, Rhode Island Daily newspaper had been brought to my attention this I think was in 1982, and it was an article that was based on an interview with an in-house technical consultant for one of the plaintiff's law firms. There was a second public interest law firm working with Jan Schlickman in the first year or two of the case. And in that article, this technical consultant for the plaintiffs was quoted as saying, and I'll have to paraphrase this from memory, "We have no evidence that these chemicals cause leukemia, but we've got to do something to somebody." That's a paraphrase. To a litigator, to a defendant's lawyer, that's a red flag. I don't have any evidence, but I'm going to sue you and claim that that you caused all these illnesses. Rule 11, contrary to the impression the movie gives you, was a well-known provision of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and it immediately occurred to me upon reading that article that this was something I ought to pursue. The second thing about the Rule 11 motion, this certainly isn't in the book or the movie, is that Judge Skinner served on the Committee of Federal Judges who drafted the amendment to Rule 11 in 1982 or 3, I forget just when it became effective. And the drafting had been finished at the time we filed the motion, but the rule wasn't going to become effective for a few more months. But I knew Judge Skinner was on that committee. I knew he was very much in favor of enforcing Rule 11 more strictly because he's Massachusetts at that time had the worst backlog in the federal system, and he was very much in favor of trying to weed out cases that shouldn't be in court early in the process. And he said so at the outset of the hearings on the Rule 11 motion. He said just the opposite of what John Lithgow, as Judge Skinner says in the movie. He said, Rule 11 is extremely important. I'm going to look to the more stringent amendment as to guide me in ruling on this motion, and based on the papers, I will be inclined to grant the motion. Now, the hearing lasted several hours. There were actually two hearings, not one, as the book suggests. They were about 6 months apart. At the end of the hearing, Judge Skinner asked the plaintiff's lawyer, not Jan Schlickman, but Tony Roisman, did you consult an expert witness before filing the complaint? And Tony ducked the question three times, changed the subject, talked about something else. But then at the very end, as Judge Skinner was leaving, said, Judge, we consulted an expert before filing the complaint, and he said there was good basis to support the allegations. And at that point, shortly later, Judge Skinner denied the Rule 11 motion. And I would say, properly so at that point. If a plaintiff's lawyer has consulted an expert and gotten his blessing, I think that's enough to go to court. What I don't understand to this day is why the plaintiffs didn't say that at the outset of the hearing rather than at the end of the hearing. The second motion I want to talk about is the Grace Summary Judgment motion. This came to deal more directly with the medical issues, but still didn't go to the ultimate causation question. I did not frame the summary judgment motion as a contention that these chemicals, in fact, did not cause the plaintiff's leukemias, although we think very strongly, we thought then and we think now, that that is, in fact, the case. Instead, I framed the motion as a contention that there is insufficient scientific evidence. There is no scientific evidence suggesting a causal link between these chemicals and leukemia. So it in essence was an evidentiary motion that plaintiffs will not be able to introduce expert testimony on causation because the experts will not have any accepted scientific literature on which they could rely. A subtle distinction, but it was important to me because I knew Judge Skinner. I tried cases before him previously. I knew he is a highly fact-oriented judge. He believes very strongly that the most efficient and quickest way to dispose of cases is to put the witnesses in front of a jury and get the case decided. So I knew a straight-on factual motion would be denied, and I wanted to try this somewhat more roundabout motion. We filed affidavits from two leading researchers at the Harvard Medical School who, in the affidavit, said there is no literature showing a causal connection. The plaintiffs encountered with an affidavit from Dr. Alan Levin, who at that time was already a fairly notorious professional witness for plaintiffs in all kinds of toxic tort cases. His affidavit cited approximately 30 articles and one personal communication, which he said draw a causal connection in the case. But, and this was very telling, he did not supply copies of those articles, just the citations. We immediately started gathering the articles. Within 2 or 3 days, we had almost all of them. None of them stood for the proposition he cited them for. We spoke to the person we had the personal communication with, who denied having made the statements that he recited in his affidavit. But before we could file a reply brief and a reply affidavit, and this was just a matter of 3 or 4 days after the plaintiff's brief was filed, Judge Skinner denied the motion for summary judgment. He did not provide an opportunity for oral argument. He did not provide an opportunity for a reply brief, which is pretty unusual. But of course, he said, I see two different experts saying two opposite things. We've got to try the case. We decided at that point not to move for reconsideration because we were beginning to think at that point that we would benefit more from letting the plaintiffs put Dr. Levin on the stand at trial so that we could work work with him on cross-examination. Let me just close by saying that there have been a couple of important decisions recently in which the defendant's lawyers took the same approach I did for summary judgment, an evidentiary-based approach, and prevailed. One of them, a particularly interesting case in a state trial court in Arizona, decided just last summer, a very long opinion detailing the expert testimony at great length, granted essentially the same summary judgment motion I had filed for TCE and leukemia, as well as other chemicals and other illnesses. I'll just give you a couple of quick quotes from this. Number one, there is simply no reliable human epidemiology that establishes a causal relationship between TCE and leukemia or Hodgkin's disease. That's in 1998. The other quote, that was an epidemiology quote. Another quote is, the plaintiff's experts have attempted to use principles from toxicology, but they didn't appear to understand them. A number of the witnesses in that case, both for plaintiffs and defendants, were the same witnesses that were involved in the Grace case.
I guess we need to change seats again. Sure. Sorry, this isn't working, so we just passed the mic back.
Let me just tell my colleagues that all of us have run overtime so far. Yeah. So
That brings us up to the spring of 1985, in which events occur that all of you are familiar with who've read the book and seen the movie, which involves changing of testimony by our own employees we had interviewed back when this case originally started. And the reason I walked you through some of the chronology earlier was to make sure you knew what the company itself had already admitted. We found ourselves in a somewhat anomalous position of, as a company, having, in essence, admitted more than individual employees had in terms of what was in the ground. We could do that because of the physical evidence that we were finding. Some of the new information was accurate. It revealed specific disposal locations that we had been unaware of on our property, and that was being information was corroborated by some of the new wells that we put in. Some of it was inaccurate, such as the rumor about 50 additional drums being buried on our site, despite efforts by ourselves, by the plaintiff's lawyer, and by EPA, no drums were ever found, and they do not exist. Nonetheless, it created a problem for us, certainly in terms of the atmospherics of this entire case, even though we had already admitted the presence of the groundwater contamination. We did go ahead with further excavations as a result in the summer of 85. We conducted excavations looking for additional areas. We invited Jan Schlickman, was president of the excavations, and was allowed to direct our contractor in doing work in back of the property. EPA also was allowed to direct our contractor and dig anywhere they wanted to dig. We spent 4 days in July doing that. And at that point, we also brought in Jack Guzwet, our field geologist's recommendation, to work on the travel time issue. Before I turn to Jack, though, I think I briefly want to ask Bill to comment on this issue of our employees.
I think an important thing for law students to learn early on is that it is incredibly difficult for a defendant to do an internal investigation when the company is accused of some sort of wrongdoing. factory employees have a code of honor among themselves. They do not want to rat on their fellows. They, of course, also don't want to get in trouble themselves. It was very hard for us to convince the employees to tell us everything they knew. It was very important for us to know everything they knew for two reasons. One, you can't adequately defend a case if the plaintiff has better access to your own information than you have yourself. You must know all the facts. Number two, and the movie, of course, completely distorts this, a company in Grace's position has to have credibility with EPA. We have our EPA lawyer sitting here in the audience this morning. So we had to have all the information we could as early as we could. So that scene in the movie where I'm talking with Al Love out in the street after his deposition, the text of that scene is almost word for word what actually was said by Al Love and me. But it's played by the actors and directed by the director in such a way that it has a 180-degree opposite impression. In the movie, I look like I'm trying to get the information so I can suppress it. In real life, I knew Al lived across the street from Ann Anderson. I knew he was conflicted about what to do, and I really wanted him to tell me what he knew so that we could develop it for our use and get it into the hands of EPA as soon as possible.
With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jack Guzla.
I have difficulty summarizing 5 minutes worth of work in 5 minutes, let alone a year's worth of work, and I'll try and do that. For those who are interested in technical issues related to the trial, I have a copy of a newsletter that we have prepared related to our efforts in the trial. You're certainly welcome to take a copy of that, and it makes reference to certain web pages that you are welcome, you know, take a look at also to get independent views on the trial. As Mark mentioned, I was got involved in the summer of 1985, and at that time, see if this is going to work here. Grace had already done explorations on its property and had determined that. You'll have to tell me if it's visible because I'm not going to look around and see it. I determined that there was, in fact, groundwater contamination on the westerly part of its property, but it did not know the source of that contamination that was flowing off-site toward Wells G&H.
Wells G&H is down to the lower left, about half a mile.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, half a mile, about a half a mile to the west, in the center of the Abergona River Valley. The principal issue was really to evaluate whether or not the chemicals could have during the next year, an additional 40 wells were installed to basically identify the location of the source of the contamination, which is in this general area here on their property, and to get information about the geologic conditions beneath the property, because the principal issue was whether or not chemicals could have traveled from the Grace property to Wells G&H, which were a half a mile away, within a 19-year time frame. The 19-year time frame results from the fact that Grace did not build the property until 1960, summer of 1960, and the wells were closed in May of 1979. So that meant there was a maximum amount of time of 19 years for Grace to have possibly been a source of that contamination. The wells were shut off after 1979. There was no doubt that groundwater and chemicals were migrating toward the location of the wells. The issue was a travel time issue. Also during, again, this is the location of the Grace property, Wells H and Wells G down in the center of the valley. To evaluate whether or not the chemicals could have reached the wells, I developed and calibrated and used a three-dimensional groundwater flow and chemical transport model. And I was the only witness to rely on three-dimensional model analyses for their opinions. During the year between I got involved and the time of the trial, there was an intensive investigation on the Grace property by Grace and within the center of the valley by EPA as part of the Superfund investigation. They were installing wells as part of their remedial investigation of what's called the Wells G&H site. And there was also a 30-day pumping test of Wells G&H, which was done in December of 1985 and January of 1986. The purpose of that pumping test was to try and replicate the hydrologic conditions that existed when Wells G&H were pumping at the rate of 1,100 gallons per minute. There was an awful lot of information and data that were generated by those drilling and by the pumping test. That information was generally available probably in the beginning, like February, is when people really started to have their hands on the full set of data, and even data still trickled in even to the day of the trial. The groundwater flow model was constructed based on the geologic logs and geologic information from all the wells that were installed in the area. The model was calibrated using the water level data collected as part of the pumping test. It was calibrated against the measured stream flow loss when wells T&H were pumping, and calibration is a technical jargon term meaning a reality check. In other words, you compare what your model calculates with what you observe in the real world, and if they compare well, then you have calibrated your model. For the chemical transport, the chemical transport analyses, about 20 to 25 simulations were made of chemical transport, assuming the chemicals were in the groundwater from the first day the Grace plant opened in 1960. So this would overestimate the potential for the chemicals to reach the wells. The different simulations actually looked at different values for those parameters which affect the rate at which chemicals move in the ground. And the reason for doing different simulations is because these parameters are not precisely known and there is uncertainty in their measurements. So we looked at ranges, high ranges and low ranges of those parameters to be exhaustive in our analysis of the travel time. And my conclusion then, and I still believe it today, is that the chemicals from Grace could not have reached the wells by May of 1979. The rate of migration was too slow, and the principal reason for that was the permeability of the material, the geologic material that existed beneath the Grace property and down into the center of the valley. There is a glacial till deposit of extremely low permeability, and the bedrock has low permeability, unlike the center of the valley, which is very permeable sand and gravel. So I'll move on to a new topic. You may have read about a wall of water, and I guess I'd like to address that. Separate from my three-dimensional model calculations, model analyses, I had done a mass balance calculation, a water mass balance, to compare the volumetric flow of water from the Grace property to the pumping rate from wells G&H. And basically what it said was that the flow of water off the Grace property was less than 0.5% of the amount of water that was actually pumped from wells G&H, which meant that the volume of water that could have, even if all of it got to wells G&H, it was a very small percentage of the water. Under cross-examination, I was asked to make assumptions, which I disagreed with, about the conditions beneath the Grace property. I was asked to assume that there was no groundwater in the bedrock, a condition which is not true. If you make that assumption, however, then groundwater rises above land surface, and it only rises above land surface if you make the assumption that there's no groundwater in the bedrock. In addition to doing the water balance calculation, I did a chemical mass balance calculation. That chemical mass balance calculation was not introduced at trial, but it was submitted to EPA in a 1987 report that I prepared. The result of that calculation was that even if chemicals from Grace reached wells G&H, that it would represent less than 2% of the amount of contamination that was actually pumped from wells G&H. And while I firmly believe that the chemicals had not gotten there by 1979, even if they had, the maximum contribution they could represent would be less than 2% of the contamination pumped from wells G&H. This was significant because it meant there obviously was a significant source of that contamination, that VOC contamination, somewhere else in the Abergana River Valley, and therefore it put an emphasis on understanding the zone of contribution, that is, where did the wells actually draw their water from? And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Mike, why don't you take until about 2 minutes out, 2 or 3 minutes out? I'm going to wait and take that long.
Assuming that some of you are going to be using the case in the book and whatever for teaching, purposes, I thought I might spend a minute or two to talk about my own particular perspective on the on actually trying the case, and then deal perhaps with some of the issues that came up during the trial. Yeah, sure. From our point of view, it was, and now I'm speaking strategy now, it was a difficult case because, as Bill has pointed out, and Jack and Mark has pointed out, we started with the assumption that there was contamination of the in the groundwater at the Grace facility. We started out with the assumption that there was conduct of Grace employees, which whether or not it would have been acceptable in the 1960s was certainly not acceptable in the mid-1980s, and it's very difficult, of course, to get people to put themselves back 20 years in time. We were certainly up gradient from Wells G&H, so there was obviously a possibility that the contamination from the Grace facility could have gotten to Wells G&H. And confronted with those situations, we approached the hydrogeological phase of the case, I'd say, with great caution, because I think we felt right at the outset that this was going to be a difficult phase of the case for us to successfully defend. We were greatly comforted by Jack's analysis. I will tell you that when we first got into the case, even when I first got into the case, which was not a long time before the trial began, Jack had not completed his work in this regard, and there was really serious question in our mind as to the extent of travel of the chemicals from the Grace facility towards Wells G&H. So that was the status we were in starting out in preparing for the case. This may not be particularly important, except I think it's rather interesting anecdotally. I didn't even know what the word hydrogeology was when I first was brought into this case. I wouldn't have had any idea what Jack Gussois did or John Drabinski did or George Pinder did when I was brought into the case. And this is for your students' benefit. What you have to do as a trial lawyer is you have to come up to speed very, very quickly on very, very technical issues very, very fast, and you've got to rely on very, very good people like Mr. Gussois or John Drabinski or George Pinder, whoever it is who are experts, to help you get there. At the same time, from my point of view as the overall lead lawyer for Grace in the case, I had the medical case that was looming right after the groundwater case. We had no reason to know that we were going to be successful in the groundwater case. I think we had every reason to believe that we might well be thrown into the medical case within some few days or weeks after the conclusion of the groundwater case. So within the firm, we had to divide up responsibilities, and while we were, I was trying the groundwater case, I had to have my eye out on the case that was going to come down, and we thought it might well come down on the causation case. As you know from the book, the strategy that we developed for the groundwater case, besides having the benefit of Jack's testimony and his expert opinion as to whether or not the contaminations could have traveled to the wells in that 19-year period, the strategy we adopted was really a strategy to look at the whole Abergona River Valley and the history of the Abergona River for 150 years. On this note, I had one personal benefit that maybe even my friend Mr. Gussois didn't have. My father actually had grown up in Woburn and had graduated from Woburn High School and whatever, and during when he was alive, during the trial, he obviously had a great interest in the case, and he used to tell me when he learned that the Abergona River was playing a rather central part in our analysis of the case, he used to tell me that when he was a child in Woburn, and he was born in the early 1900s, so let's assume he was 1915 or whatever, he said even where he lived, which was Grove Street, Dan, I don't know if you know where that is, even from where he lived, he could smell the Abergona River, and everybody in Woburn knew that it was the one of the most contaminated and heavily industrialized parts of New England. When we looked at the whole frame of industries in that particular area, and this is some point where the book is certainly, the movie particularly, is certainly misleading, we saw an industrial wasteland. I don't know what you'd call it. I mean, 150 years of industries pouring contamination into the Abergona River.
from fertilizer companies to chemical companies to tanneries and whatever. And then when we looked at the fact that the city of Woburn had placed these wells within a stone's throw of this river, this then brought us into how little people seem to understand groundwater and hydrogeology. One of the big issues in the case, and one of the big issues in the book and the movie, is this judge's decision to trifurcate the trial, and the fact that how this played in the strategy of the case. That was something that we pressed the court to do. One of the reasons that's not brought out in the movie or the book, which is not related exclusively to the emotional impact that would have occurred had the families testified at the beginning of the case, and whether or not from that point on you could have ever asked this jury to consider anything as difficult and as technical as the hydrogeological issues or the causation issues. There was a serious concern that if the plaintiffs testified earlier in the case and testified about the illnesses that they had suffered and the families had suffered, that if then that was followed by what we thought was not credible evidence that these could have been caused by trichloroethylene or tetrachloroethylene, the whole issue of whether or not these chemicals had left the Grace facility or the Beatrice facility and gotten to the wells would have completely been obscured. It would have been sort of a bootstrap sort of thing. Well, the people were sick. These chemicals caused the sickness. They had to come from somewhere. They must have come from there. Well, our view of the case was just the opposite, and it was the one that the judge adopted, I think, correctly, which was first you have to, from a causation point of view, you have to show that the conduct of the defendants had in fact caused the contamination in the wells, which had in fact caused the illnesses, and it was smart and logical to start with that issue first of causation. It had because first of all, it had the problem that I've just cited. Secondly, if they could not establish that the chemicals had arrived at the wells, they obviously were not going to be able to establish that the conduct of, in our case, Grace, had led even to the possibility that the chemicals could have been related to the... I'm told to be quiet. I'm going to say only one other thing, and that just because I think it's interesting. On the jury's verdict, and I'll be very brief about this, the jury's verdict... was such that, and I reread last night our motions for a new trial, it was so obvious when the jury submitted the answers to the questions, and I think the plaintiffs probably realized it, I see Bill Crowley in the back now, realized it as well, that the jury simply had confused the issues in the case. They had found that Grace had contaminated the groundwater before May 26 or 2nd, 1979, but they were unable to determine how far before that date, the date the wells closed. So that was a very, very serious problem as far as causation was concerned, because the plaintiffs had obviously suffered the illnesses and been diagnosed at many times prior to the date the wells were closed. They also answered a question having to do with the presence of chemicals at the wells, and it wasn't clear whether they meant when conduct of Grace had occurred or when the chemicals were there. So when you read the jury's answers and then you read the judge's decision allowing the motion for a new trial, it was quite clear that they just didn't seem to have gotten it. Now, we were not happy with the questions that the judge posed. I don't think the plaintiffs were happy with the questions that the judge posed, but the judge really had no choice at that time, however, as he says in his order, but to have the case retried again before you could possibly go to the second phase of the trial. I've taken too long. I'm sorry.
In September 86, as you know, the Grace did settle with the plaintiffs. A lot of activities happened over the past 12 years. One of those is that we resolved our Superfund liability with EPA in a settlement. And that was done on a cooperative basis, both with EPA and the community, unlike all the interactions we had with everybody from 1982 to 86. We've worked in, a more successful manner since 1986 in how to solve these problems. Part of the reason we were also able to proceed ahead with EPA and get that settlement done is that the issues under Superfund are, in fact, different than the issues in personal injury litigation. The temporal aspects of who contaminated the wells when didn't have to be addressed, and thus all parties were able to avoid relitigation of those issues. There is important information that has some bearing, however, on some of the temporal aspects. One of the things I also did is I asked Jack Guzwa to stick around after the trial ended and actually design our groundwater recovery and treatment system, and he's been doing that and overseeing that for 12 years because, among other things, I just wanted to see if he was right. So I'm going to let Jack talk a bit about the new information.
I hope my voice holds out. And pumping antihistamines to fight off the cold. As Mark said, there has been considerable investigations within the Wells G&H site since 1986. I'll try and summarize those. At the Gray site, there's been a design, construction, and operation of a groundwater extraction and treatment system. That system began operating in September 1992. At the UniFirst property, similar design, construction, and operation. That system was turned on in September 1992. It's in fact a coordinated remedy between UniFirst and Grace. At New England Plastics, the investigations determined that this was a source of VOC contamination to groundwater. A system, I believe, is a shallow air sparging soil system is in operation now, and a groundwater system is being designed and to be constructed. At the Beatrice property, or the Riley 15-acre property, a remedy was turned on within the last, I think, 3 or 4 months, or maybe within the last year. This actually turns out now, after all these investigations, to have the highest levels of TCE contamination anywhere in the site. At Olympia, investigations have begun within the last year, and the results of those will then determine what, if anything, needs to be done at the Olympia property. There are also, these are called what are called 21E properties. That's a Massachusetts Superfund law designation. There are investigations that determine that there were sources of VOC contamination on these properties also. MIT has done a study of arsenic and chromium in the area of the wetlands associated with Wells G&H. It's part of a watershed study looking at the transport of metals from the area, the upstream watershed, down to Mystic Lakes. They've documented a fairly extensive region of arsenic and chromium contamination in the wetlands adjacent to the wells. And the U.S. Geological Survey has issued a report that describes, and it's probably the best source of information, describing the zone of contribution to Wells G&H. On the Grace property, since 1986, an additional 35 wells have been installed, and including 22 extraction wells. Those extraction wells are located in the source area, at a small source area back behind the building, and along the westerly and southerly property boundary. 22 extraction wells, they pump a total of 7 gallons a minute on average. They are taking all the water out of the ground that they can get. This confirms the low permeability of the till and bedrock beneath the Grace property, and continues, I believe, to support the opinion that I had that it was the low permeability that prevented the contamination from reaching the wells by May of 1979. We need to wrap real fast, so why don't I just stop? Read the USGS report.
I hope that this chronology gives you a better feel.
I'll pick this up.
I hope this chronology gives you a better feel for what we knew as we went along here and gives you some a feeling for why we believe that, in fact, we did not contaminate the drinking water supply in Woburn. A lot of this information, some of the information Jack talked about is on our website. We're going to continue to load on historical information because we know that students like to look at this stuff, and that will be a continued resource. I'd like just to close by coming back to what I said earlier on. I know, you know, lawyers get interested in this stuff. I think the real lessons are elsewhere. You know, our goal as a company today is to try to operate in a way so that we don't end up in another seminar like this at Harvard Law School or anywhere else, or have nice people like the plaintiffs here suing us over these types of issues. Thank you, and we'll try to take a couple of questions. Dan.
But I would observe that the jury pretty specifically rejected his theory. And I wonder if one of the lawyers could comment a bit on the act of continuing to deny what the jury so clearly found 13 years ago, whether that's a socially responsible act?
Let me talk to the first one first, and let Mike and or Bill talk to the second one. Just briefly on the medical issues. In fact, the real issue here were the leukemias, which occurred, and all of us agreed, occurred in a statistically abnormal way in Woburn. I think it's fair to say that if the medical part had gone ahead on the neurological and immunological issues, those in fact would have been shown not just to not have been caused, but in fact not to actually exist except as plaintiff's experts' artifacts. And so that really, I don't think, was an actual real concern of ours, as opposed to the real issue here, which really was the leukemia. And I guess you can, either one of you want to speak to the actual jury verdict?
Well, I would just say the judge did vacate the jury's verdict. It has no legal standing. That's a technical answer. I think the truth is that the jury did not understand the testimony, and that's a more practical reason, perhaps, for not thinking of it as something that should have some ongoing binding or nature or validity to it. Mike, do you want to add to that?
Dan, this gets into a larger subject, which I think at some point I hope law professors devote some attention to, which is the whether or not the system we have to make the judgments about the movement of groundwater or the causation of leukemia in a courtroom under these circumstances with these kind of jurors, under these kinds of pressures, with these kinds of advocates, is where you want those determinations really made. My own personal view is that the jury verdict was a compromise verdict. I think they thought they were giving a little and taking a little. I think that it was prompted by the fact, as you know from the book, that the foreman announced to the judge after 6.5 days of deadlock that they could not reach a verdict. He sent them back for 2 more days. Then the foreman presented himself to the judge and said, "Your Honor, unfortunately, I have to go in for a heart bypass operation on Monday." The judge said to him, "Well, I'm not going to obviously hold you up for that, but you should advise your colleagues that I will substitute one of the jurors that's in reserve, and you must begin your deliberations all over again." This is after they've been deliberating now for 8.5 days. I think what they thought they did was they were splitting the baby between Beatrice and Grace. This is my own view. And that as to Grace, by finding that we had contaminated the wells, that by the time the wells had closed, but refusing, as they were asked to do, to give a date for that contamination, they were splitting the baby even further. So I guess my answer is not unlike Bill's answer. I can't give a great deal of weight, Dan, to that determination. Certainly, I cannot give it the kind of weight that would cause me to fold up my tent on this issue and say that I cannot, from a point of view of corporate responsibility or advocates' responsibility, make my own determinations as to what actually may have happened.
Well, okay, I just wanted one comment and one question. Dan actually, two things. Dan actually made some very good suggestions in an article in the Boston Phoenix back in December about ways to try these cases, which I think I read that and would have been very happy to have tried the case under those terms. The second point is the reason why I'm saying that, in fact, I'm trying to draw the concern I have all along is the focus on the litigation versus what happened in Woburn, and that's why I very deliberately have said at the end that we are confident that, in fact, we did not contaminate the wells.
You mentioned the Judge Skinner's decision that essentially vacated the judgment, granted a new trial. The book suggests that that order was backdated as part of the settlement agreement with Grace. Would you all like to comment on that?
It was not backdated. We had always told the plaintiffs when we discussed settlement in this case that we believed that the motion for a new trial would be vacated. In fact, shortly within seconds of the jury verdict, Judge Skinner suggested to me, that he knew we were going to be filing a motion. There was not any way in the world that we were going to settle that case with that jury verdict outstanding. at finding Grace having contaminated the wells. We knew the judge was going to throw it out anyway, and when we went and talked settlement, we were sort of talking on two parallel courses. One was we hoped we were going to settle the case, but we were not going to settle it if the judge was not going to vacate the order. But the order was definitely not backdated.
Let me just add to that. I have a vivid recollection of the court clerk taking the verdict form from the jury foreman and handing it up to Judge Skinner. Judge Skinner started reading it to himself silently. None of us, of course, knew what it said at that point. And Judge Skinner said, "Oh my God, we're going to have to try this case all over again." It was that apparent on the face of the verdict form that it could not stand. So I think the motion for a new trial was a foregone conclusion at that point. I think we have to stop now because the next session starts shortly. I'm going to stay down here for a minute. That's just what I wanted to ask. I'm going to stay down here now for a minute, and if people will give me suggestions, we're going to redo this at 11. I know you've seen it and want to see other things, but we would like to have suggestions about ways that we can make this more useful to you. Also, I can give a reference to the Arizona State Court decision in the Motorola case if anyone wants to have that reference. Yeah, let me just, I don't know what to do with this.